So grab the spear of life and aim it, and you'll be guided by edutainment.
So there's this concept that we put together called edutainment. So edutainment is a combination between entertainment and education. So we want to make education entertaining.
So grab the spear of life and aim it, and you'll be guided by edutainment.
Live and direct, syndicated coast to coast, you're listening to the Easy Way Broadcasting Network. I am Mo Rock alongside my co-host, Dr. Mark Voss, and this is the Edutain Me radio program where we mix education and entertainment. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to, first of all, give a special thanks to our sponsor, Chef Anina, for sponsoring this show. Secondly, before we get into our special wonderful guest, I want co-host Mark Voss to say hello. This is the start of our first official season here on the syndicated Easy Way Broadcasting Radio Network. We have been on different sister affiliate stations before, but we inked the deal and we signed the deal last week. It's official. We're part of the Easy Way family. Dr. Voss, professor at many prestigious institutions, including Chapman University. How are you, brother?
Couldn't be better, man. It's good to be back on the show, getting this off the ground again. And I know we're definitely going to have some exciting content information to share with our guests and with our listeners.
With our listeners, and those listeners out there are going to be super excited to find out who we have. First of all, just to give a little bit of a backdrop, if you guys hear a dog bark, if you guys hear a little bit of a fire twinkle, or if you guys hear something cooking in the kitchen, it's because we are inside the prestigious, lovely, beautiful, self-designed home of a dame, somebody who has been honored by President Barack Obama with a Lifetime Achievement Award, somebody who has inspired millions of people around the world with her work through various different corporate and charitable organizations, somebody who travels to third world countries, spends time and resources from her own money to help impact, influence, and enhance the lives of others, a person who is humble yet operates many multi-million dollar institutions. You would never know that if you converse with her, for she is very grounded and she's very humble. Dame, knighted, Miss Dr. Shelley Hunt, how are you?
I am good. Thank you, Mo. Pleasure to be here.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to sit here with us. One thing that has always amazed me about you, Miss Hunt, and I've been a fan of your work for years, is you've been known in the public eye as somebody that has brought awareness to many spiritual, esoteric issues, and you've enhanced the consciousness of people around the world. Consequently, you also operate a multi-million dollar enterprise. Many people in capitalist society can't really correlate the two together. They think to make millions and millions of dollars, as you do, you need to have a vicious cycle to you, kind of the whole dog-eat-dog world. So how do you justify being somebody that is esoterically involved and spiritually involved with your ability to produce and generate millions of dollars?
Well, I believe that Source constantly speaks with us, and I believe that we all have gifts and talents and a uniqueness that we're here to share with the world. And many people, we're usually given and shown our gifts and talents somewhere between 7 to 9 years old, and then we're showed them again about 12 to 14. And many times we don't lock in on that. You know, we kind of fall into society's, you know, what I should do, not what I'm called to do. And I think that, you know, a lot of people go, well, I'm just going to live my purpose. And I'm like, okay, that's great. And I'm just going to live whatever I'm passionate about. And I think that's great. However, you need to hone it in to do what you're good at, right? So whatever talents you are good at is what you need to bring to your calling. And so people operate a lot on passion, and I believe operating on both levels. So not only what you're good at, but also what your service is for humanity and to be here to play in.
As I'm sure you're aware, you know that a lot of people grow up into systems or institutions that in one form or another guide them or lead them to do certain things that might not be their life's calling. So a lot of our listeners, you know, especially from our old platform that we operated on, they don't necessarily know what their life calling is, and they think they figured it out and then later realize that, no, this is not really the way that they thought their life would go. Do you have any recommendations or any kind of suggestions of how people can discover their life purpose?
I think that people don't discover their life purpose. I think they know. I think they know what they're here to do. I think that they know, and please, for the love of whatever, do not pay someone for you to discover what you're here to serve on. I think there is something that calls all of us, whether it be children, whether it be energy, whether it be elderly, whether it be poverty, whether it be anything. I think that there is, we know inside ourselves. And deep inside ourselves, it's like there's this vision, you know? And sometimes people, I think, are afraid to even, like, speak the vision out loud, you know? And I think many times what happens is we start to put it on a shelf because we do get into systems, you know? And we get into our habitual habits, and it becomes a 9-to-5, and it becomes, and I don't mean, there's nothing wrong with a 9-to-5.
Oh, no.
But however, I'm talking about the systems. You know, we'll get up, go to, you know, have breakfast, go to work, come back, put your butt on the couch, watch TV, go to sleep, do it all over again. And we start to get into these systems of survival. And one of the things that I know is when someone is in survival mode, they cannot flourish.
Right.
And so it becomes a habitual system for us. And then our vision of our purpose of service becomes kind of smaller and smaller, and it gets pushed away on a shelf and kind of farther and farther away, and we look at it less and less and less. However, it always lives. There is a light of service that lives inside of every human being, and, you know, it's just, do they identify it? They all do, but do they call it forth?
Interesting. So, you know, you talk about service. I think that's a very crucial point there because, I mean, if you look at every system has a function within it to serve, if you think about it.
Correct.
I mean, why do we have an economy? To serve others.
You know, correct.
Ultimately, that everything we do as CEOs, as business owners, as teachers, as lawyers, as doctors, is to serve other people.
Correct. Even if it's an invention, it could be anything. Service comes in many forms.
So how can we create a system that is both humanitarian and allows people to discover what they can do to become better servants of people, of humanity?
Well, I think the first thing is to recognize that we all have gifts and talents. I think the next thing is to be able to honor other people's gifts and talents, because so many times we're trying to do it by ourselves, and we can't do that. We're not put on the, God didn't put us on the face of this planet to play alone. And that's what I honestly believe.
Well, you know the Carl Sagan quote, right? we are the universe discovering itself, right? So we are consciousness that each gets its own unique experiences on this planet to understand or to better comprehend not just human nature, but the nature of the universe and the singularity.
I agree. And, you know, I think this is a soul journey. I think that people look at it like they're just trying to get through it, you know, but it's a soul journey. And if you look at everything that has happened, I've had some really great things happen in my life and some great honors. And I've had some really horrible things happen. Well, what people would call horrible, but there were gifts and there were strengths and there's character that's built and there's many things that come through everything. And, you know, instead of looking at like just putting your head down and trying to run through and get everything over with so you can have this moment where you don't have anything.
Okay, I have to ask you now because I had the honor to speak with you in private before we started the show. And, well, if we create these systems to serve other human beings, why is it always that these systems become detrimental to the well-being of the people that serve in it?
I don't think necessarily they become detrimental. I don't, well, maybe they do, but I think that the start of systems is because it's to serve, right?
Right.
And so at the moment of inception, it may serve. However, everything is changing. Nothing is constant. The only constant is change. And so, you know, people get stuck in their habits and their systems. And it's kind of like, as we evolve as human beings, as we evolve as humanity, as we evolve as a society, our systems need to be updated too. So, because what is that saying? We learn to live in a world that ceases to exist.
That is a brilliant, brilliant quote.
Right?
Absolutely.
So that's what I think about
this. I'm just sitting here watching the two of you speak about these important subject matters, and it's exciting to me to watch two brilliant minds talk about these important issues. And I couldn't help but notice that Miss Dame Shelley Hunt oftentimes is continuously speaking about how is it that she can contribute to the betterment of other people? If you guys notice, we've had the fortune of interviewing many CEOs, many business owners over the years that we've conducted this show both on and off. Of course, there have been a couple hiatuses out there, as many of you know. Most of these CEOs that we've spoken to have consistently spoken about their company, the vision of their company, and most of the times you get the feeling that they see the company as an extension of their own ego. But this is a very unique circumstance in which we see a very powerful woman that has created thousands of jobs in her life for the American people sit here and constantly talk about, and you can sense the sincere aspect of her aura, how she's just focused on helping others. And it's amazing to me because we've been told our whole lives in this economical system that if we want to get ahead, we need to think about our own head. You know, we need to think about that brain inside of our own head, and that own ego that we have. But standing next to us is an example of somebody that doesn't operate from the ego, but still has the ego not only surviving, but thriving. Now, there's many people sitting right now meditating in a hut somewhere that also believe in compassion and empathy, but they don't have the economical standpoint to enhance the quality of their lives from a three-dimensional perspective. So this is amazing to me to find somebody that's able to balance both and thrive in both perspectives. Shelley, if I may call you Shelley, what is it about the American CEO that needs to change to bring more happiness and joy to the American people and bring more trust between the average everyday consumer and the 1%? Because there's a lot of mistrust right now from middle class America and the upper echelons of America. What is it that you could say to build a better relationship between these two economical fractions in the United States?
Well, I think that service is king, right? A man or woman is paid in direct proportion to the service they render to others, to mankind, humankind. And I think that service is king. You know, I do a lot of marketing for a lot of companies and a lot of other things. And one of the things that I always look at is, where are people at? You know, you have to look at, you know, and it's more than just the typical BS of know your consumer. Mm-hmm. You know, where are people genuinely at, and where are they functioning at, and what are they looking for? And, you know, there's cyclical cycles that go around for different things. If you look at how the 80s operated, we were in a very right?
Yeah.
The movie Wall Street. I can teach you to be a millionaire.
Yes, exactly.
I can drive that sports car. I, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Right? And so you have all that, right? And then we came in, and all of a sudden we kind of went through this other transitional period, you know, and we're still in it. You know, it happens from time to time if you look at the cyclical cycles of advertising and of successful businesses and everything else. We're in a very service place right now, customer service. People want to know that they matter. We're in a we. We're not even in an us. We're in a we society right now. We're in a place where, how can we come together to make a difference? How can we play differently? Don't tell me you're going to make me $1 million. Don't give me BS. Nobody believes the BS anymore, and they're in a very real place. They have been so watered down. You know, my daughter does this thing. She talks about millennial marketing, and she does this really incredible presentation. And it's really funny to me because I helped her figure out some of the stats. And our children and us, but really children, are inundated by so many different modalities of just crap and advertisement. Like, they're just so numb to it, whether it's online, whether it's on TV, whether it's, you know, in magazines or whatever. We're just inundated with sales pitches. You know, and so it's kind of like we almost turn off, right? So if you want to do something and you want to be able to bridge the gap, one, employees matter. People matter. There goes my little dog. Okay, you warned him. People matter. And if anybody would like a little white dog, please just let me know.
Call into the show. We can. You can be the lucky winner, right?
Sugar, stop it. And so people matter. Employees matter, you know. People will serve me something in a restaurant, and I make a point to say hello to people. You know, all people matter.
Now, do you think
when your employees get that they matter, then they want to do something more. Mm-hmm. Then they don't want to just clock in and clock out. There's an importance there. That's number one. Number two, making sure that the customer knows that they matter. Mm-hmm. I love, and one of my things with all of my business stuff and everything I do is I do 110%. I never give 100%. And I demand it of all of my people because that's how we serve.
Mm-hmm.
So that's customer retention, right?
Right?
If people know you're on their side, really. So I think right now it's we. I think it's how you treat others. And I think it's how you play out there in the world, truly.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Wonderful, wonderful. And, you know, I want the CEOs out there to know.
If you could see these two guys, this is a dichotomy here.
It
okay?
is. But that's what makes the Edutain Me show so special and so unique.
You got Mo Rock, and he's all kind of cool and rock. And then, you know, of course, we have Mark, who looks like Darwin, you know, he's putting his hand on his chin.
Yeah.
And he's all analytical. I love this. It's a great combination. I just have to add that.
Well, thank you. If we get the stamp of approval from the queen of marketing, we're doing something right. What's interesting to me is this, Ms. Hunt. You know, we have a lot of CEOs in this country that seem to operate with the mentality that numbers are the end all. And consequently, we see that over the years, a lot of them may start with good intentions, but they get a little jaded. How is it that you have been able to not only survive, but thrive in the most powerful definition of that term, truly thrive in corporate America, without losing that humanitarian edge that you were instilled with, without being jaded, and without losing touch of who you are? What is it that kept you going this strong, that keeps you going so strong in battle, in the trenches, without losing touch of your human side?
Well, I think there's a couple things. One, I think it comes down to individuality, you know, of how we're playing with ourselves. You know, I know when I opened my first company, it's like I'm always pushing the borders of my life, whether it's spiritually, knowledge-wise, emotionally, physically. I'm always pushing the borders. And I don't mean like a lemming. I'm not going to the edge and jumping off. And I've seen people do this, and they just, oh my God, it's disastrous. So it's not about being a lemming, but it's about challenging yourself to play bigger, to do more. And, you know, I opened my first company. It was scary. Know where your scary point is. Know where your scary point is, right? And then you need to lean out just a little bit more and push your limits, your boundaries, the extension of yourself. And then, oh my gosh, I got to hire, you know, a couple employees. Oh, how am I going to do this? You cannot grow and play alone. So again, you're pushing the boundaries. And you keep pushing the boundaries and pushing the boundaries. But I think one of the biggest things is when I went from two companies to three, I got scared. I know where I feel it in my body. I know how it shows up in me. Some people go into confusion. Some people go into standstill. Some people go into lockdown and plow down. Some people back off.
Yeah.
You know? And I think so the first part of it, I think, is knowing ourselves.
Mm.
You know, we're in a three-dimensional world here. We need to have some financial success to be able to really do our purpose much bigger.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. You're saying all these words, and I couldn't be helped but remember a book I read long ago that is one of my favorite books by Susan Jeffers. It's called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And one of my favorite quotes in that book is, remember that underlying all our fears is a lack of trust in ourselves. And you're talking about knowing yourself. You're talking about going to the edge of fear. I also couldn't help but remember Ralph Waldo Emerson's essay of self-reliance, and all these historical people come to mind, both modern and both, you know, from hundreds of years ago. What books would you say to the aspiring entrepreneur that's listening, would you recommend? Because clearly you have a philosophical approach to your business and to your life. And this has clearly been obviously inspired somewhere, somehow, somewho. So can you give us a little insight on what it is that Dame Shelley Hunt reads in her spare time or has read that has helped mold you into this spiritual, enlightened entity that you are that's always helping create opportunities for others?
Every day I read Think and Grow Rich. Matter of fact, all of my people do. It's one of those things, you don't have to read the book from cover to cover, but I highly suggest you do. And then, and I've done it many times, and I just kind of open it, and wherever it falls is where we read. So I love that. I love Bob Proctor's Born Rich. There's, you know, universal principles are universal principles, and it's in so many different arenas. You know, I think that for people, you should go where you're called. What draws you that you're drawn to, because that's the knowledge for you at this moment. That makes
exactly,
sense.
Exactly. I tell my students this all the time, especially in my sociology classes. You know, if you're interested, I know this is kind of an odd pitch to do on the air right now, but if you would like to come speak one day in one of my classes, I think they could learn more from you in an hour than they could from me throughout the whole semester, because I'm, you know...
You're their teacher.
I'm their teacher. They have no choice but to
that's
listen
right.
to me. But, you know, we were talking earlier about systems and that there is some kind of disconnect between the individuals and the larger groups. And from an anthropological perspective, you could say that the nation state as they currently exist is and specifically nationalism, is a very unique phenomenon because in the original anthropological perspective of what a society is, it started with families that grew into tribes, that grew into nations, so on and so forth, so that everyone was connected to the community that they ultimately ended up serving. And to add to that, the macro-micro continuum, I'm not sure if you've heard of that, but it's, you know, basically where the individual and the larger society
is... The collective.
Correct. The collective comes together, right? The society comes together, and how that intermixes. It seems to me that there is kind of a disconnect between what the individuals want and need and what the larger institutions where individual and society come together desire. That there's, you know, a disconnect between those
well,
two.
Well, and you know, that's a long answer I could give you, as you know, because we've talked about this kind of on the sidelines here.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we have... Are you talking in general, like worldwide? Or are we talking the United States right now?
What is easier for you to answer or quicker for you to answer?
Probably the United States. I think right now in the United States, like I said, we're in a we. Mm-hmm. However, there's a great divide because we have a lot of organizations, governmental institutions, educational systems, and everything else, corporations.
Oh, right.
That are working in an I.
Right.
And that's part of the problem, getting back to what I was saying earlier. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the dysfunction and disconnect.
So on the one side, we have that spiritual disconnect between these multinational corporations and what they want, and ultimately one of the founding pillars of what this country is, which is we call capitalism, right? So I'm sure you've heard in the news that a lot of people are attacking capitalism for a lot of the problems we have in this country and
yes.
in the Western world. Do you agree with that, or do you think it is crony capitalism?
I think we've lost capitalism. I think this country was founded on 97% of entrepreneurs, and I think we're not fostering entrepreneurs. And I think that you know, I teach and
yeah.
I've taught in many universities, you know, on different subjects, but this is one of them, you know. And I think that... we definitely are bringing up medium warm. I have to think of how I put this. lukewarm blue-collar workers, we are not bringing in future leaders. We are not fostering entrepreneurialism, which is what made our country great. And it is highly hindering the American family. And I am all about the average American family. Yes. You know, I was a single mom. Mm-hmm. I raised my daughter by myself. You know, I mean, I get it. And I love going in and seeing where people are at. You never forget where you come from, you know. Oh, yeah. If you truly are doing the work, you're always learning. You're always understanding. Mm-hmm. You're always touching and reaching out to people, not being in your own little bubble. But I think that, you know, we're definitely lost some of what makes us great.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're speaking about this eagerness and this desire to stay hungry. And it reminded me of a quote. Lots of things you're saying are reminding me of quotes today. That Steve Jobs said, which was, stay hungry, stay foolish. Now, I'm sure many people out there know you've actually worked with Steve Jobs. And as somebody who has an insight with Steve Jobs, working with him on a personable level, what are some insights you could tell us about the man and some things that you learned from the gentleman that you could share with us and our audience?
He's very humble, and there are a lot of people that were intimidated by him. And the comment that was made when I walked into the boardroom for the new technology, as I thought to the first thing I thought to myself was, oh, good, there's another girl in here, except for I found out she was a secretary. Mm. And so I sat at this table, and I was the only one in there, and someone turned around, one of his advisors, and they go, who is she? And he goes, don't let the peacock feathers fool you. Mm. This is kind of funny.
Well, that is just an insight on the perceptive nature that Steve Jobs had. And there's a German phrase, and my German co-host who teaches German linguistics probably knows what I'm talking about. It's the finger pulse.
Oh, no. You mean Fingerspitzengefühl.
Exactly.
Fingerspitzengefühl. Right?
Say it with me.
What's that?
Finger.
Spitzen.
Gefühl.
Gefühl.
Sehr gut. Very good.
That was
okay.
Much better than me.
So please explain to the audience what that term means.
Well, that term originally came from a German general known as Erwin Rommel. He talked about Fingerspitzengefühl, or the feeling you get at the tip of your fingers for when you're very perceptive of how to maneuver on a battlefield. Specifically,
exactly.
But you can apply this to everything else in business and school and education and so on.
So Steve Jobs had a Fingerspitzengefühl.
Why don't I just say it for you?
Okay, let's do that one more time. Steve Jobs had a
Fingerspitzengefühl
for Miss Dame Shelley Hunt, in the sense that he recognized that behind the soft, sensual, beautiful exterior was somebody that was beautiful, of course, on the inside, but had an edge and an understanding of business strategy. And many people know Shelley has been on Forbes.com. And it's not a joke. And people need to realize that to be successful in life as an entrepreneur, it's not only about making money. Because you could make money, but what have you done to really stimulate the economy? I've learned that if you stimulate the economy, if you're creating jobs, if you're creating opportunities, that is the emblem of power and success in the world of business, particularly in our capitalist or pseudo-capitalist modern economical corporatist system. So I believe that we need a paradigm shift in the sense that people need to stop thinking about how to make money and people need to think about how to open doors for others. Would you agree with that, Dame Shelley?
I would totally agree with that. I think that, you know, like I said, it's a we, and people forget to ask. And people forget to, you know, what can we do together? Mm-hmm. How can we create something bigger together? Mm-hmm. And being able to do that, I mean, I know with the Women of Global Change that has been a phenomenal thing to do. And, you know, how do you go from, you know, where we were at, which, you know, was a couple $100,000 a year organization that, you know, 100% of it goes to the charity humanitarian aid, but to hundreds and hundreds over half a million members. And how you do that is you do it by tying in together. How do we play together? You know, how do I serve you? What are you doing? What am I doing? You know, people see things as competition.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. There is no competition. The only competition is of self.
Mm-hmm. It's the law of abundance. Now, you're a woman who runs an organization with over 500,000 members. It is 2016. One of my favorite world leaders is Trudeau up there in Canada.
Kevin Trudeau?
No, that gentleman is in prison.
Never mind.
Justin Trudeau, I believe, correct?
Okay.
And
the Prime Minister.
The Prime Minister of Canada.
That one.
Mr.
Got
Trudeau,
it.
Kevin Trudeau is a good friend of mine. He'll be out of prison soon. Kevin, we love you. but Justin Trudeau, who I don't know personally, he was one of the first, actually the first world leader to have an equal number of men and women serve him in his staff. And when he was asked by a journalist,
yes, he was.
You know, what inspired you, motivated you to do this? Prime Minister Trudeau kind of gave a puzzled response in his facial expression and said, I mean, it's 2015. This was a few months ago. And I thought that was a brilliant response because, honestly, that's the quintessential response to make to such a frivolous question. Now, as a woman who's in a position of power, who runs an organization with over 500,000 members, among many other enterprises you own, do you still feel a little energy of awkwardness to your American male CEO counterparts when you come across them, when you do business with them? Is there still a sense of condescending feelings you get from them, or do you think the playing field has been equal? Because you are definitely in the minority being a successful female CEO in the United States.
I am a minority, actually, and you know, I think women have a valuable asset in the boardroom. And so do I perceive personally, you know, a difference? No, I do not. In other words, I don't look at someone I'm working with and go, you're a man or you're a woman. I'm like all about getting the job done, right? And having fun and creating things. However, I do see it when I teach at Cal State Long Beach or I do other things. You know, I teach in the engineering department and in innovation, and I also teach in the business strategy department. And it's just very interesting to me because, just for example, the president of Cal State Long Beach said, we have a problem. And I was like, really? And he goes, I need to talk to you about it because we're just not attracting women engineers. And then I ended up with one of the guys in D.C. who, you know, heads up all the colleges and does the numbers and everything else, whatever. Mm-hmm. Long story short. However, it's affecting our science. It's affecting our technology. It's affecting our advancement here in America because we do not have enough women taking on specialized fields. So when I go in and I teach these classes and I'm in this big auditorium and I have a couple hundred students, if I have a couple hundred students in engineering, I have a couple hundred male students and I may have 20 female students in this whole entire group. And we think differently. So women think differently, and I think that it's an asset, you know, and I think that we're not there yet. I think we've come a long way, but I think we have a long way to go. Mm-hmm. I think when we fully function, you know, more so between the equalities, because more women are entering college right now, but less are going into specialized fields. We're over 64% of the workforce, the blue collar workforce right now, but we're less and less in management positions. And you would think that we would be, and mm-hmm. that's a hindrance.
Mm-hmm. I have something that I think fits into this really well. I may remember what the quote was. There was a really brilliant quote that basically said that you are what you make of it. Like, you reach out and you take it. It was Matt Drudge who said, when you play on other people's platforms, you're playing in their world, right? You're playing on, like, Facebook. You're playing on their world.
Okay.
Or if you go to these Google search engines or any other major corporations, you're playing in their world. Well, he says, create your own. In other words, don't go into a field that you think is, oh, I need to go into that, or I need to play in their world. Bitcoin plays a role in that too, you know. It's an alternative currency, or they don't call it that, as a commodity, but
yeah,
you get the point.
I do.
So basically, what can we do, not just for everybody, to create their own playing field in engineering and in business instead of following the paradigm?
I think limitations are a matter of perspective. Matter of fact, that's like one of my slogans. that really limitations are a matter of perspective. People say you can't have a business mm-hmm. without, you know, go raise $200,000. People say you can't do this unless, because you've never done an invention. You don't even know how to begin a patent.
Right.
You can't do this. Like there's all these paradigms. And the truth is, for every obstacle, this is how I view life. There are a million solutions. And let me tell you, when I chase that rabbit down the hole, I'm going to find one. Because that's how I play. I will not take no for an answer. And that's, I think, really important.
I couldn't agree with you more. I honestly, that's my philosophy as well. I mean, adversity ultimately builds character. And you should welcome problems because it allows you to grow out of them. You know, they say adversity builds character and wealth creates monsters. You know, we've been very fortunate in the U.S. We've had more wealth than we have ever seen in the history of the world.
Oh, people complain more and more. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny because I hear so many Americans complain about this, that, and the other thing. But yet, the countries that I travel to, when you're eating a cup of beans and rice, a half cup, and that's what you're feeding your child for the day, mm-hmm. and they're drinking dirty water because they don't have any clean water, mm-hmm. and there's no health care, and the upper end is, you know, lifespan is 45. Give me a break. No, I hate to say it that way, but it's true.
I think we've lost sight of our priorities.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think that gratitude plays a big part in things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I was watching a speech you gave earlier this year on YouTube, and you spoke about some of the work. And you spoke about some of the work that you've done with Women of Global Change, and you shared a wonderful story about you in a third world country. Unfortunately, it's slipping my mind, where you happened to be building, I believe it was a well at the time, or perhaps it was a hospital. You spoke about two or three different stories and experiences you've had, and you mentioned how you were eating with some volunteers that came with you on your journey, and through the corner you could see several people poking and looking at you. And
Well, I was talking about comfort and convenience, and you know, I have people that come from all over the world to go with me. They come for business strategy, and then I also have them experience a third world country. Because I think it's part of it. And so many of them are like, I could just write a check. What am I doing here? And I'm like, because you have to be an active participant in the change that you want to see on the face of this planet. We can't just sit back. It's too imperative right now with what's going on in the world. However, I had taken them and I was working at an infant care unit center in the middle of Honduras because I had gone to Honduras. And one of the things that I discovered was these babies were being born to parents that each had AIDS. And I was astounded to find out that the babies that were born didn't have AIDS. And the only reason they were getting AIDS is because there was no food, so the mother would breastfeed the baby, and the baby would get AIDS. But the children were born without AIDS.
Wow.
And I was like, holy crap, we could get rid of this in a generation, right? You know. So anyways, I ended up going over there, and I did an infant care unit center. And then there was like a little walkway that we built, too, that one side housed the mothers, so the mothers could stay there. And then the other side, there was an American nurse put in and a couple years worth of formula and all this other stuff for the babies. So we're working on this project, and I've got probably about 75 people with me, not including staff, and I've got staff there. And, you know, people were complaining. A couple of the guys were complaining. Actually, they're like, I'm hungry. And I'm like, this is like 12 noon. And I'm like, and we've been on site since probably about 8 in the morning, 7:38. And I said, well, lunch is coming, and they went, all right. And so I purposely called my staff, and I said, I want you to hold off on lunch. And they were like, what? I said, you need to hold off on lunch. About 2 hours later, I'm hungry. I'm like, yeah, I understand that. I said, when's the last time you ate? We ate at 7 a.m. this morning. Okay, all right. Okay, and so anyways, I'm watching these families, there's shanties that are all around this infant care unit center that we're building here. And I'm watching all these, they got little kids and they're playing. And what I love about little kids, and especially in other countries and anywhere in the world, is they're just carefree. They're just themselves. They don't understand social class. They don't even understand you're eating dirty water. They don't even care. They're just amazing, right? Yeah. And so I'm watching these kids and they're playing and I'm watching the mothers and I'm, you know, watching everything that's going on. And so they were complaining, my group. They're complaining because they don't have lunch. They're complaining. And of course, we had water. And it was our water that we brought. Because you can't drink the water there. If you cut your hand or something, you can't even wash your hand out. Yeah. And so, anyways, the lunch came. And everybody's just, you know, a lot of people are just scarfing up their lunch because they're hungry. They haven't eaten. It's 7, right? 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2. It's 7 hours since their last meal. And I sat there, and I was looking at that. We got a half a chicken apiece. Wow. And then some salad and some rice and stuff. And I was looking at my meal, and I started to take a bite, and I looked up, and there was, like, these little kids, and they're watching me. And I don't know. All I know is I got up, and I said, you know what? One meal's not going to kill me.
Well, you know,
and I walked over, gave them the meal. What was interesting is later on, some of the others in the group gave them their meals. And what was really interesting to me is while they're like, I just want to eat, okay, several of them, not the entire group, but several of them were like, I just want to eat. What these people did was so beautiful to me because what they did is they actually went and called the people in other shanties. You would have thought it was Christmas dinner, and they all gathered around. So they could have taken that chicken that we gave them and all the stuff that we gave them. And meat is very rare there.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? So here we're giving them, they could have taken it inside their little place and kept it all to themselves, but they didn't. They called other families, and they called other people, and you could hear them yelling, and they're all coming, and it was like a Christmas dinner. I mean, it's just a whole different deal.
So that was the story that really touched my heart, and what it made me reflect on as an American, as somebody who's a first-generation American, born and raised in a small town in Minnesota, and, you know, I lived a lifestyle as blue-collar American as it gets. I mean, if you want to talk about pheasant hunting and fishing and tailgating outside of, you know, some football games, I'm the guy to talk to. But what's amazing to me is I often wonder, if we replicated this scenario here in the United States, if we went to an average neighborhood and presented a family with, let's say, a box of goodies. Now, it could probably be more than just a plate of chicken, but let's say maybe, a box of jewelry or presents. Would you think that it would be a similar situation where that family would take it to their neighbors, or do you think they would just take it inside their house? And if the latter would be more accurate,
I think it really depends. You know, I grew up in Boston under a house, and I'll tell you, in the neighborhood I grew up in, it was an ethnic neighborhood. And here's the thing, you know, we would go from house to house. Kids would just eat. You know, I mean, it was a, I don't want to say survival, you know, but in some ways, it was a community. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest thing with America is we wait till disaster hits for us to show up in community. And it's like, why are we not showing up in community all the time? Because it's really what's needed right now.
I mean,
America's turning in slowly to a third world country. And I don't know if people realize that. You know, I was asked to go to a couple different places in America when I got the Lifetime Achievement Award. And I said, what? I almost paused for a minute because I was like, I feel safer sometimes in a third world country than I do at times in downtown Detroit and downtown Chicago. There, you know, there's
look at how those cities are built, too. I mean, you know, there are some urban planners who say that suburbanization has led to a disconnect between people in the community that they live in, you know? I mean, how many people do you know their neighbors or people?
Well, and that's the thing. People need to take their communities back.
Yeah.
People need to take their environment back. We need to take our government back. There's a lot of things in this country we need to take back as people, as the people, and as the force of this country. We have totally gotten out of tilt. And I think that's part of what's going on. And the only way we can do that is to have a movement together and to join forces together and say, enough.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
This is the Edutain Me Show on Easy Way Broadcasting Network and our sister affiliate network stations. And you're listening to Dame Entrepreneur, Lifetime Achievement Award recipient from the White House, Shelley Hunt, who's speaking with us here today. Shelley, we got about 10 more minutes until we hit the top of the hour. But one thing that I did want to wrap up the show with you was, we've spoken a lot about economical issues. We've spoken a little bit and we touched base about what your fellow counterparts are doing differently as far as American CEOs goes. I want to touch base a little bit on, and I know this is kind of funny on my part on bringing this up when I know we have such little time, and it's certainly not a subject that could be wrapped up, but I would hate myself when the show is done if I didn't take my opportunity to ask you this, you know, seeing as how hard it was for us to get you. What is your idea on the law of attraction and the power that we have to change our reality with energy?
Wow. I hope you have longer than 10 minutes. But I'll try to put it into a nutshell. I believe that the law of attraction is like attracts like. I believe even scientifically, right? You know, that which you are is that which you attract, even energetically. If we looked at it on a molecular level, we have cohesion. Why? I have cohesion. This table has cohesion. Why? Because of how it is gathered, right? The likeness of it. So I think that that's part of it. But I also think that we're affected by other things that are around us. So depending on who you're hanging out with or what you're doing, and we talked about that earlier, and that is kind of if I'm in the middle of Compton, which I have been, you know, hanging out with Living Color or whatever, I'm going to be a little bit more guarded walking down the street as a woman, you know, being my color. I'm going to be a little bit more cautious walking down the street. And not to say that there's anything wrong with that place. However, there's an environment that's with it. And so, you know, if I lived in that all the time, my walls would come up and I would be very defensive. And you could take me out of that area, but that defensiveness doesn't go away. It now becomes a part of who I show up as out in the world. One of the things that I love is being able to play with people that are smarter than me. I love that because I get smarter. Oh, yeah. I love to be the dumbest person in the room. You know, I do, or the not smartest person in the room.
That's how you grow.
That's how you grow. That's how you learn. You want to play with people that are bigger than you.
Now, I want to know this, Dame Shelley Hunt. Can we expect a book, a audio lesson, or a seminar for us to learn more about your philosophy towards these matters as far as your approach on teaching us how to change the energy and be more in tune with us? How can we have an opportunity to expand our horizons more with your teachings?
Are you looking for where you can find me? I love the way he says that. That was really eloquently pretty and just like all the way around. Okay, I have Success is by Design. I have a new book coming out, Those That Serve Succeed, and it's with myself and Bob Proctor. That's coming out in the middle of the summer. I have a woman series, which is the power, the business, and the spirit. You know, you want to find me, you'll find me.
And please, to those that are listening, this gentle lady is so huge. She is so huge, like a star, that I can't even believe that we were blessed enough to actually have her not only be a guest on our show, but invite us in her home. And I'm just so humbled and blessed by God to know this woman. Now, I want to touch base on our official sponsor for today's show. She is the top five most requested celebrity caterer in all of Hollywood. Weekly Billboard has named her 2015 Chef of the Year. Achievers Magazine has named her one of the rising entrepreneurs in the Hollywood area. Miss Queen of Beverly Hills, the queen and magician of food, Chef Anita. Can you please briefly, we only have about 3 more minutes till the top of the hour. Can you please just say hello to our audience? And we want to thank you on behalf of Easy Way Broadcasting and Fortune and Gazette Magazine for you, your sponsorship, helping us with this show.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for believing in what we're doing. Now, Chef, you've you know, cooked for Oprah Winfrey, you've cooked for celebrities all around the world. What is it, and I only have time to ask you a couple questions, but what is it about food that you're so passionate about? What is it that you think is so magical about food creation? And I know that you call yourself a food inventor.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about food that makes you so full of life?
Well, I think that the main ingredient is always love.
Mm-hmm.
People call me the food inventor because when I go cook, they say, oh, I don't have that, and I don't have this ingredient, and I don't have that. And I'm like, wait a minute, you have everything you need, and if it's not going to be that recipe exact, you're going to make it magic with your love, with how you cook it, and food. Why is it my passion? Because I want to feed the world. Well, actually, I want to feed the kids. There's 15 million children that go hungry every day in this country, and I want to make a difference there. I think that we all have to be aware that this is going on, and you don't have to do magic or crazy things. You know, just go buy a turkey and donate it to a shelter, or buy blankets, or just small things.
Practical things.
Yes.
And that's why I'm so blessed to have Chef Anina be our official sponsor. Blessed to have Dame Shelley Hunt as our official guest. I also want to thank The Good Pizza for being another one of our sponsors. And, of course, any closing statements from my wonderful co-host, Dr. Professor Mark Voss?
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking with Ms. Shelley Hunt. And, of course, Mo, it's good to be back on the air with you. And I think with this show and with guests that we have on here, we can better serve the community and entertain while we educate.
This is the Edutain Me Show. I am Mo Rock, and you have just been edutained.
So there's this concept that we put together called edutainment. So edutainment is this combination between entertainment and education. So we want to make education entertaining.
So grab the spear of life and aim it, and you'll be guided by edutainment.